In business, as in life, loyalty should never be rewarded with complacency. With a Barclays Business Account, the longer you stay with us, the more of your monthly bank charges we'll give you back. It's called Loyalty Reward, and it's our thank you to businesses for being a customer. We just think that's business common sense. To find out about moving your business account to Barclays, visit us in branch or go online at barclays.co.uk/businesscommonsense. Terms and conditions apply. Only available on selected price plans.
For years and years, heating has meant boilers, and boilers have meant breakdowns. Over here and over here. Anything but music to your ears. At Fisher Future Heat, we create state-of-the-art home heating systems that we fit, then you forget. With no annual servicing needed and a huge 10-year guarantee. In short, we engineer common sense. Search Fisher Future Heat today. Fisher Future Heat. The future is electric.
Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello, I'm Matt Hansen.
And I'm Tristan Riddell.
And you're listening to the Nerd Party.
Talk nerdy to me.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Welcome to episode 20, and tonight we have a really special episode for you guys. I'm really excited to do this one because, as you know, at the end of every episode, we tease what we're going to do in the next week, but we don't outright say it. Like, we're not saying like, okay, we're doing a top five of our favorite movie moments, or we're doing a top five of our favorite CGI usage in television. You know, it's a theme, a piece of music, or some trailer music or something like that. And so you never quite know what you're going to do or what we're going to do. And last week we did the Superman theme.
But we need to put a disclaimer. Our topic this week isn't the Superman franchise. Sorry for those of you who tuned in thinking that was it.
Exactly. That's why I wanted to bring it up, is that we're not doing it on the Superman franchise. We're not doing it on Man of Steel. We're not doing it on anything TV related. But what we are doing it on, and why I'm so excited, and I think a lot of times this is overlooked, is our top five favorite pieces of music from movies, as in scores written by composers specifically for a movie.
And just to say up front, we're not picking out the five most iconic scores. We're picking our five favorites. I would never say that the five that I've picked are the best scores or themes written for movies ever. They just happen to be five ones that either I really like or that I listened to or moved me in some way the first time I heard them.
I'm so glad that you pointed that out. You said, like, we shouldn't do the best of, or what we think is the best, because it's so subjective, and you just, like, you can't make a best list because so many pieces of music especially, interact with people on a very deep level and a very different level. And, you know, like, you look at some of the greats with, like, Gone with the Wind or Lawrence of Arabia or Jaws or Chinatown, you know, like, things like that. You know, like, those are some of the greats and could be considered some of the best, but they're not necessarily going to make our favorite list.
Right. So just to put that honesty up front, this is going to be our personal favorites. And if you agree, that's great. If not, tell us what your personal favorites are. You always have ways to reach us, and that we mention at the end of every podcast.
But before we get into that, I think we definitely need to talk about some recent nerd news. And there's one piece of nerd news that I think stands above the rest, at least for you and I.
And one that just came out recently. We're not 2 weeks behind the times on this one.
Yeah.
This one came out on Friday.
Yeah, we do a bi-weekly podcast, and that has its advantages, but also some of its disadvantages. But this time, it doesn't affect it. And that is the Spectre teaser trailer.
That's right. We've mentioned in the past that you and I are both big James Bond fans. We've liked the last few movies, especially. I was a big fan of Skyfall, saw it multiple times, so I was eagerly anticipating this follow-up. And even though there have been some rumors regarding its production issues and problems, I think all of that was safely put to rest on Friday when you get to see the first glimpse of what the new movie has to offer. What did you think of the trailer?
I love teasers. I mean, I love teasers more than trailers. And I'm a big trailer fan. And I think this one did not disappoint because it gives you a glimpse of the look and the feel of the film, or what we think is going to be the look and the feel. It's very classy, very streamlined, which Skyfall very much was. I think out of all the Bond movies, Skyfall was beautifully shot, and it had this edge to it. The clean lines and just like stark landscapes. And I mean, Bond is always known for its exotic landscapes and great locations and beaches like Nassau, you know, and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, like, you know, huge boat chases. But this one focused much more on the intrigue. And I mean, that's where a lot of great Bond-isms lie, is in the intrigue and the mystery and the discovery.
Yeah, and I have to, you know, in danger of using an old movie tagline and cliche, when I saw this trailer, I was like, well, this time it's personal. And it looked very much so. I mean, like, I realized Skyfall was pretty personal. We got into the backstory. This one, though, teases a lot more Bond backstory than I think we've gotten in any other film.
Well, I mean, it's hard to imagine getting even more backstory than Skyfall, because it delves in, like, because here's the thing, in Casino Royale, this branch of Bond, this reboot, is they're doing it right, because, you know, with the previous Bonds and calling that like the initial timeline and everything like that, very much focused on the mission not really the progression of character, but just, okay, this is Bond in this vista, this is Bond in this mission, you know, this is Bond in Russia, this is Bond in Germany, you know, like stuff like that. And with this reboot, it's much more focused on Bond as a character, which I think is a much needed change for the franchise. If you look at our successful television, it's our serial films and serial television, it's much more character focused than in the past. In Casino Royale, you see the beginnings of Bond. You see him before he is technically Bond, you know, like, and that's why we don't get the theme until the end of the movie. And then you see him in Quantum of Solace, where he's on this vendetta to kind of avenge Ava Green's character. And then you have Skyfall that deals with his past and battling with his past. And then you have this one that's almost a continuation, maybe.
Well, I certainly think it's picking up on some themes. Now, here's the thing, is that Quantum of Solace and Casino Royale were connected in, mm-hmm. you know, in the fact that Quantum was almost a direct sequel to Casino.
Right.
And then we had Skyfall, which kind of felt like it was its own thing. And I wonder if that was for the benefit of the 50th anniversary at that time or what was it. But it turned out fantastically. I'm not complaining. However, I feel like what we've seen in this 1.5-minute glimpse of Spectre is that last year, around the same time that Captain America 2 was released, Marvel released a hashtag on Twitter that said it's all connected, referring to their TV and mm-hmm. and movie universes. And that's the thing that came to mind when I saw this Spectre teaser, is that maybe this is going to connect Skyfall to this bigger story, and somehow these four films are all going to be intertwined somehow.
Oh, that's an interesting take. That's an interesting thing to think of.
Because if I'm not mistaken, that guy from Quantum, was his name Mr. White?
Yeah.
Is going to be in Spectre. I've heard this.
Yeah, we saw him. He was in Casino Royale, he was in Quantum of Solace, and now he's going to be in Spectre.
So I wonder if we're going to find out more about how this shadow organization, and I think it's going to be, speaking of Captain America 2, I'm not saying that they're going to rip it off, but I'm saying that I think it's going to be very similar to the S.H.I.E.L.D. Hydra thing. That's my theory, with MI6 and Spectre.
Obviously, I don't know. I don't think that's going to be the case. I think it's going to be much more of a, I don't think they're going to integrate MI6. Like, I don't think they're going to do that, because they already kind of did that with Skyfall, where they're like, we have people everywhere, you know, like, or, and I'm sorry, not in Skyfall, but in Quantum of Solace, where Mr. White says we have people everywhere. I feel like they've done that. Okay, so we know that there's a sinister organization. I think they're going to put more focus on unraveling what Quantum is or it wasn't.
Well, okay, if not MI6 and Spectre being intertwined, I do think we're going to find out that Quantum is some sort of offshoot or arm of Spectre.
Absolutely, 100%. I would put money on it, because we all know that the reason why Quantum was not Spectre to begin with, because of rights and behind the scenes crap, and we've gone into that before when we've talked about it.
But now they have the rights back, so now they can connect it.
Absolutely. And they're treating this the only way that they could, only way that they legally could. And so for that, we're applauding them. As soon as they got the rights, they introduced it. And I don't even need them to go into an in-depth analysis of Quantum. I need just Mr. White to say, like, oh, Quantum was just the beginning, Mr. Bond. You know, and then bam, end. That's it. That's all we need.
Well, you know, just running through the things that I liked about this trailers, you know, instantly when the trailer begins, you get more than a few connections to Skyfall. We see the old ruined MI6 building that was destroyed in the last film near the beginning. Mm-hmm. We get Naomi Harris back as Moneypenny, which we knew she was coming back. But my hope for this film is that she stays as, well, maybe not as involved as she was with Skyfall, because I don't know how they're going to do that. But yeah. I like this new Moneypenny, and I like this new active Moneypenny more than just, you know, a pretty woman sitting behind a desk who flirts every now and then with Bond. Like, I just enjoy her. So I hope we get to see more of her. And then we start getting into some of the newer stuff and teasing this backstory. And it looks like it's going to connect to Bond's family in a sense, which is why I think we're going to get more of his backstory. And then, of course, the cherry on top of the end is we get to hear Christoph Waltz's voice, and we get to see a shadow figure sitting at the very end of a long table. There's no cat, but this is supposed to be this Oberhauser character. And I think I texted you this when we were talking about the teaser on Friday. And I'm like, at this point, I'm going to be shocked. I would be more shocked if they're not trying to pull another John Harrison with this Oberhauser character.
And for those of you who don't know, John Harrison was the name, was the code name for Khan in Star Trek Into Darkness. You know, like they said, they're like, oh, it's not Khan, it's this guy named Harrison. And it turns out it was Khan, just with the code name of Harrison. And so I think you're right. They're denying it pretty hard. And Christoph Waltz himself said that he's like, oh, no, I'm not playing Blofeld. It's something much more interesting than that. Well, you know, it could be something like they could be wrapping it much more interesting than that. But I don't know. I mean, maybe they've thought of something that we haven't, but...
Well, either that or they're just... See, because even though I'm more of a fan of Into Darkness than you were, I kind of felt like the pre-release material was trying to do this whole song and dance and try to do everything to convince you that it wasn't Khan. Mm-hmm. I kind of feel like with this teaser that you don't put Christoph Waltz in the shadows at the end of a long table saying, it's been a long time, Mr. Bond. Mm-hmm. And then cut to the Spectre logo without making you think that he's probably going to be Blofeld. So I wonder if they know that we think that this is what's happening.
It could be a lot of reverse psychology going on. It could be like, oh, we know you think this, and so we're going to promote it as it is so that you're even more shocked in the theater.
Which, if that's the way it's going, as long as the story is good, then I'm all for it.
But, oh, yeah, like, I'm not going to be disappointed at all if he's not or if he is. I mean, we're just conjecturing right now, but I think either way, I'm just excited that Spectre's back.
And I'm excited that, let's be honest, I'm excited that Christoph Waltz is the villain.
He was born to be a Bond villain.
Especially following up from what I think was one of the best Bond villains in this new universe with Javier Bardem.
Yeah, I mean, it's just... Everything in Christoph Waltz's career was leading up to this point. I truly believe this.
So, you know, I'm thrilled to pieces that he's the main bad guy in this, and I can't wait to find out how the rest of the cast works into it. I am so excited for November, and I can't wait to see more. But before we move on to trailers real quick, there's just one more thing that's worth mentioning. And this happened, I think, more than a couple weeks back. I've been, you know, we on the show have been tracking all the pre-release stuff for the new Avengers Age of Ultron. And about a week and a half ago, they released a TV spot. Now, TV spots these days don't usually contain new footage. They're usually much more abridged and kinetic versions of what you've already seen in the main trailers. However, they released this TV spot a couple weeks ago that had a ton of new footage and was sort of a roll call trailer. Mm-hmm. And I was very excited over it, but then I texted you that it was out, and then you watched it. And I think this is the one time where I was really excited, yet somehow you managed to be more excited than me.
Yeah. I don't know what it was about that TV spot, but it got me jacked for the movie. And I mean, I you're the Marvel fan, and I have a love-hate relationship with the Marvel Cinematic Universe. it kind of goes up and down for me. But I always thought Age of Ultron was going to be a good movie from the first trailer. But I had with the first trailer with the Pinocchio music and everything like that, it grabbed me. I was like, okay, this is going to be a great film. And then all the subsequent trailers were great, but they didn't catch me like that first one. But then there was something about this TV one that really just made me giddy, where I was just like, oh, not only is this going to be an epic movie, this is going to be a fun movie.
Well, that's exactly my theory is I think that you were attracted by what I think a lot of the people were attracted by this new TV spot, which is, you know, a lot of these trailers have been dark, and, you know, we touched on this show before that a common concern among the general public is that this one's going to be lacking the fun. And you and I never thought that, because it's Joss Whedon and he knows what he's doing. But I think they just made this TV spot just to alleviate those people, because even you notice at the end, after you see all this cool, fun stuff happening, they give Ultron this weird line of like, okay, it's time for some fun.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's going to be a movie line or not. It sounds more like a trailer line to me, but I think they're like, don't worry, people, you see that this is, they still have the jokes.
Yeah. And not only that, but just, there was a lot of great little bits, you know, like that just made you just go like, oh, that's going to be cool. Like Thor hits Captain America's shield with his hammer and it just goes flying into a couple of people, where Captain America like just hits a button and then it just magnetizes his shield up to his arm. You know, just like stuff like that just really gets you going. It's not only the funny parts, but it's also the fun parts.
Well, as a massive Captain America fan, I have to say he came off really well in the trailer, because he gets the moment with his shield, he gets the moment working with Thor, and he gets an awesome moment of him flipping off his own bike and then swinging the bike and destroying a Hummer or something.
And not only that, but he gets that moment where Tony says, I'm not the boss, he's the boss, and we juxtapose it with Captain America. And that's just cool, because one of my favorite moments in Avengers is towards the end when when Iron Man says, call it, Cap, and then Captain just lays down the law on who's gonna do what. I love that moment.
Right, and that's what it's consistent with what I've heard from Joss Whedon in the pre-release materials, that Iron Man funds, Captain America leads, because he's the soldier. And, you know, we see him have everybody kind of having this buddy-buddy relationship. I have a feeling, though, that it's not going to last throughout the film, because Joss Whedon has already said that this film ends up, things are okay, but things are not okay.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And, you know, of course, you know, after Ant-Man this summer, the next release is Civil War. So we have to get to that point.
Well, we absolutely 100% need to move on. We spent 17 minutes on one teaser trailer and one TV spot, and we could spend another 17 minutes easily on this stuff, but we need to get to the main topic. And as we talked about at the top of the show, our main topic is our top five favorite scores from cinematic masterpieces. Now, this is not the collection of the entire score. These are individual themes and tracks from within an entire movie. So it's not like, oh, we're going to choose all of Psycho or all of King Kong's score or all of Vertigo's score. You know, no, what we're choosing is, you know, just those individual pieces of music that really stuck with us and really meant something to us. And music that was specifically written for the movie, because there's tons of movies out there that have a theme where it's not just orchestral or not just musical, but it actually has lyrics, and we're not going to talk about that.
Or, you know, some movies' themes were borrowed from classical music, because, you know, as I was thinking of my list, I was like, well, what movie scores do I love, or what movie's themes do I love? And one of the ones that came into mind was 2001 A Space Odyssey, but that's all classical music. So I was like, well, I'll put that aside for now.
And I also have a few honorable mentions towards the end that we won't focus on too much. Now, as we normally do on the Nerd Party, is we go in descending order with our 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. With this one, I know exactly what my absolute favorite is, but the rest are in kind of no particular order. Like, it's like my 5 through 2 could be interchangeable between 5 through 2.
Well, in that case, why don't you give us your first pick then, Tristan?
All right. Well, my number 5, I'm going to say, is from The Dark Knight. Mm-hmm. It was written by Hans Zimmer and James Newton Howard, and it's called I'm Not a Hero.
Thank you.
and also frustrating part of the score from The Dark Knight, at least from a soundtrack perspective when you're listening to it, is that it's not just, okay, this track is from this point in this movie and this track is from this point in this movie, is that several of the tracks are combined from several different points in the movie,
yeah,
and vice versa. But the thing with this track, and I'll say it again for those of you at home, I'm Not a Hero, it's so fantastic because this, it kind of turned scores on its head when it came to superhero films, where with Batman Begins, I mean, it had a lot of great music, and I don't want to say it was music by the numbers, because that's too critical, and I don't mean it to be critical. It's much more like, oh, it's your average superhero score. You would believe that you would hear it, but with Dark Knight, there was just something different to it. There, like they pushed the limits a little bit, like where they used, you know, instruments and sounds and, you know, digital instruments that you don't normally hear in a superhero song. You know, it's not mm-hmm. it's not all just like overarching cellos and strings and brass and everything like that, but it's very mechanical and it's very different. And with this track, it has this percussive beat, like, and just like, you know, Batman puts his foot on the ground and then all of a sudden it just hits, like in this one moment where like the sky hook comes and just pulls him and Lau away from Hong Kong. Then it gets into your more typical orchestral sound. Wow, this is Batman. And I'm a huge Batman fan, and so I think that's why that's definitely on my list.
Yeah, that's a great thing, and I do remember, you know, I've only seen The Dark Knight a handful of times, but Hans Zimmer is such a genius with scores, so I knew, especially you as a huge Batman fan, that he would be on your list. So, you know, I'm surprised it's all the way down at number 5. It makes me wonder what your number 1 is.
Well, like I said, I mean, like, my 5 through 2 are interchangeable. So this could be my second choice. This could be my 5th choice. You know, like, I just chose to start off with Batman because I would be remiss if I did not have some sort of Batman score on here.
Right. So my number 5, we'll keep with the superhero theme for a second, is something that a lot of people said was kind of forgettable. And maybe it's not the most iconic of superhero themes. I think the recency has a lot to do with it, but it's the main Alan Silvestri theme from the Avengers, that first one. It plays over the end credits. It's a motif throughout the whole first movie, and the reason I picked it is because I just remember how it made me feel in the theater after seeing it that first showing at midnight with all the fans. I, at that point, was not the Marvel fan that I am now. I had seen the movies before then in the theaters and kind of thought that they were fun. And then that right before the first Avengers came out, I saw them again and I was like, you know what? I have a really good time with these films. I really hope this Avengers film is going to work, because something like that hadn't been attempted before, where you cross over a bunch of superheroes into their first group feature. And just seeing the sheer joy of everybody combined with that theme and feeling like this huge sense of accomplishment after the film was over, and hearing that theme over the end credits was so much fun. And I just remember the next day coming home and loading up iTunes and not even getting the whole soundtrack yet, just that theme. And I put it on my iPod and played it for like that whole summer. And so that theme, I'm kind of sad that Alan Silvestri's not doing Age of Ultron. It's another composer, but I have heard that theme is going to be incorporated into whatever the new theme for Age of Ultron is. And so I'm kind of glad that they have kept part of their original identity. It's Brian Tyler who's doing Age of Ultron. Brian Tyler and Danny Elfman.
Brian Tyler and Danny Elfman. I freaking love Brian Tyler. Like, Brian Tyler does not get enough I don't think he gets enough love for what he does. I mean, because here's the thing is that, like, he, like, a lot of his movies are not that great, but his work in those movies is fantastic. Like, you know, he did the music for Constantine, which I think is a very underrated movie, and his score really set the tone for Constantine, sometimes more than the visuals. And he also did Alien vs. Predator, Requiem, and Rambo, Eagle Eye, Fast and Furious, The Expendables, and even he did Iron Man 3, which I thought was really good music.
Yeah, he's already, for Marvel, he's already done Iron Man 3 and Thor 2.
That's right.
So it's not his first Marvel score.
And he also did music for Star Trek and Enterprise.
And did he really?
Yeah, he did the episodes Kanemar and Regeneration, which I thought was some great stuff. And also, something that's really near and dear to my heart is he did Frank Herbert's Children of Dune. And a lot of people criticized the music from the first Dune, the miniseries made by Sci-Fi Channel. And so he kind of gave it a different feel and a much more upbeat feel. And everybody loved it.
Well, what I do know of him, too, is that, and I might be talking nonsense at this point, but I do know that I think he's the one who did the new reorchestration of the Universal Studios theme for the new logo that came out a couple of years ago. I think that's Brian Tyler, actually.
Like, yeah, that's right. I think he's going to do a great job. I think he'll do great in Age of Ultron. I feel like Danny Elfman has kind of gone off the wagon over the past
couple
years. I
wonder what they're bringing him in for, because, like, originally when this pre-release material came out, it was always Brian Tyler was the single name on Age of Ultron.
Yeah.
And then when the group poster came out a few weeks ago, that's if you magnified the credits, that's when you see music by Brian Tyler, special appearance by Danny Elfman, or something like that.
Yeah, I will just have to wait and see. And Danny Elfman is so distinct that we'll be able to tell. But to go back to your Avengers, yeah, I feel like that is I kind of forget about that theme sometime, but that theme is so, it's kind of like it's just progressive and togetherness and like it just screams teamwork, and I really like it.
The thing that I loved is that's they played it in its full glory the first time that they're all together and they're doing that circle shot of all of them getting ready.
Right. It works. It just works. All right. Well, my fourth one, it's another one by James Newton Howard, but not Hans Zimmer and James Newton Howard, just James Newton Howard. And it's from The Village, and it's called The Gravel Road. Heard me talk about this movie
for some reason,
and I know that you don't understand it and you don't have to, but this movie, it caught me at the right time, at the right moment in my life, and I think it's beautiful. And the absolute main reason why I think it's beautiful is the music. The score is phenomenal, and the thing that really just like pushes it over the top is not just James Newton Howard's score, like not just his music, but also the violin work by Hilary Hahn, because that is very distinctive, very, very distinctive violin work. And it really sells the film and it sells the moment. And this theme in particular, The Gravel Road, just really, really ties everything together. And it's also the music that I used in my first short film that I ever made.
Really?
Yeah. And so that's another reason why it holds a special place near and dear in my heart and why it's made this list.
Well, you know, credit where credit's due. Even films that aren't necessarily brilliant can have brilliant scores. So I'm not going to begrudge your Village entry.
Thank you for the backhanded compliment there. But
I'm just trying to make a point. Like sometimes, like really, like I've seen movies that I've not liked at all and thought they had great soundtracks and scores. So,
and I've also seen movies that I've absolutely loved and was like, what the hell happened with this music?
Right.
But yeah, I know a lot of people have their own opinions about M. Night Shyamalan and specifically The Village and around this time in his directing career, but this one I love. What's your number four?
My number four is an entry by the great James Horner, who, you know, has scored a lot of movies over the years, has won Oscars for his movie work. We as Star Trek fans know, of course, that he scored Star Trek II and III, which have some of the best Star Trek music. But the piece that I selected for James Horner comes from a movie that you and I have talked about constantly on this show, and that's Aliens. And nice. And specifically, the track is called that I've selected is called Ripley's Rescue, and this is the score that plays after the Marines have been attacked for the first time, and Ripley takes charge and barrels the APC down to go rescue them. I find so interesting about this theme is that it's become kind of like trailer music for action movies. Like it, like I know other action movie trailers have used this score in particular. What I also find really interesting, though, as a Star Trek fan, is that there's that old saying, "Art from adversity." And from what I understand of the production, the music production for this movie, is that James Cameron really didn't give James Horner a lot of time to create the score for this film. It had to be done on the fly. So as such, a lot of the motifs in Aliens and his Alien scores were reuses from other scores, including his Star Trek scores. And what I find so fun about Ripley's Rescue is that not only is it a heart-pumping action score that's so kick-ass, but it also uses motifs from his Star Trek III score in the theme that he wrote for the Klingons in that movie. If you listen to the Klingon theme from that movie and you listen to Ripley's Rescue, there's so many similarities because he just simply didn't have enough time to write something new. But again, Art from Adversity, he managed to take what was kind of a slow, intense theme in Star Trek III and make it into this pumping, thrilling action scene theme. And I love it so much. I have it. I listen to it when I need to get pumped to do something, so... Ripley's Rescue from composed by James Horner from Aliens is my number four.
I mean, at least he stole from himself and not from somebody else, you know?
Sure. But you know, like I said, he take lemons and make lemonade. It was fantastic.
James Horner is a monster. He is just, if you look at his filmography, it is filled with some of the greatest scores and greatest films of all time. I mean, the man just knows what he's doing, and he can go from style to style to style. You're going to laugh at me, but my favorite James Horner score is The Mask of Zorro.
Really?
I absolutely love that score. I loved that movie as a kid.
I'll be honest with you, I forgot that he did that one.
Yeah, he did that one. It was 1998, and it's the same year that he did Deep Impact.
But the problem with those is that they were all overshadowed because the year before he had just did Titanic, and that's all anybody was talking about at that point.
Yeah, and he also did Apollo 13. He did Braveheart. I mean, the 90s was his decade. But like, not only that, I mean, like he moved on into some other really great stuff. Like he did The New World, which is really, like, I really love, and he did Avatar. You know, like another James Cameron connection, and he's slotted to do Avatar 2 and 3.
Well, they've made up since Aliens, because I do remember James Horner saying he wasn't very happy with James Cameron at the time and probably wouldn't do another one of his films again.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that they've pushed that all aside and that they're going to work together again.
Success and Oscars change people, because let's not forget Cameron gave him his Oscar. So,
oh well. To move on, my number three is, you can't have a conversation about music and movies without mentioning this man's name, and that's John Williams. John Williams is, you know, arguably the best. I mean, I really do believe that you could say that, and I feel like, I mean, it's all up to opinion, you know, it's all up to personal opinion, but I really do feel like people could argue that he's the best.
Right. He's not foolishly, I didn't select one of his scores, but I'm glad you did, because the man's done so much work and so much iconic work that he has to show up. He was bound to show up somewhere. So I'm glad it was with you. So I'm very curious to see which one of his many, many scores you selected.
Well, see, the thing is with that is that a lot
you
of
picked,
like
you picked one that no one's heard of.
No. I didn't do that. But I didn't pick the most obvious one, and that's the Star Wars theme. I didn't pick that one.
Right.
But because it was just too obvious, you know, like, because that means so much to so many people that like that could be like if we were going to argue the best scores of all time or the best themes from all time, I think you could argue that one.
I'm surprised that most people go Star Wars, because with him, for it's just personal opinion again. For me, when I hear John Williams, I think of Jaws.
Well, I mean, you know, that's the thing is that like, and also, you know, he works with Spielberg the most. And so you have Jaws, you have E.T., you have Indiana Jones, you have Schindler's List and Saving Private Ryan, Jurassic Park. I mean, these are just amazing themes all across the board. But the one that I chose was from The Phantom Menace.
Continue before I say anything.
I know, I like, and I know people are like, what? Why did you choose that one?
Let me guess, though. Phantom Menace is the one that gave us Duel of the Fates. Is it Duel of the Fates?
It is Duel of the Fates. Yes, it is the... When I was in my little 1999 mind, and I saw that trailer for The Phantom Menace for the first time, we see Qui-Gon Jinn and Obi-Wan Kenobi, and they pull out and activate their lightsabers, and we see this bad guy. We have no idea who he is, what his name is, what he does, why he's there, why he's evil, but he has his red and black face, horns, and then he pulls out his red lightsaber, flips it around, and boom, double-bladed lightsaber, and you're just like, oh my god! You know, you just like, you lose your mind, and then all of a sudden you hear this music, this amazing music. I mean, like, John Williams did the first three Star Wars films, and you could say that those are some of the best pieces of music ever for film, and then you're like, how is he going to do any better than that? Why is he even trying? And then he pulls out this gem. Perfect for the fight scene, and because I was a young person and this, like, I was already a Star Wars fan, but this really cemented it into my bones. This music just this is the music, like, if I was ever in any kind of battle, whether it was with a squirrel who stole my lunch or if I had a lightsaber and I was battling a Sith, this is the music that would be playing in my head.
Yeah, and you know what, I can't fault you at all, because I heard it recently again, and it's a fantastic piece of music. And I think that even the most Star Wars fans who don't like the prequels, and, you know, again, I think that the prequels are not the best movies ever made. Let's just put it mildly. I think everyone agrees that Duel of the Fates is one of the best things to come out of the prequel era. So
I completely agree. Like, it is one of the best things, if not the best thing, to come out of the prequel era. And the thing is that, you know, like, as I said before, I didn't think that he could outdo himself, and he did. And now he's going to be doing the sequel to Star Wars. He's going to be doing Star Wars The Force Awakens, Star Wars 7. And, you know, the man's 83, and he still has original stuff.
Is he 83? I had no idea the man's age.
He's 83. He turned 83 in February, and it's just he's still going. Now, like, here's the thing, though. Since we're going to have offshoots, we're going to have standalone Star Wars films,
He's not going to do all of them.
Yeah, exactly. He's not going to do all of them. And so I feel like a composer can be like, okay, well, good. Okay, we're, you know, like, I'm not going to be standing on John Williams. Like, I'm not going to be replacing John Williams. I'm just going to be standing on his shoulders for this film. Now, God forbid if he, you know, if John Williams retires, to put it lightly, before Star Wars 8 comes out and somebody else has to do the music, they're going to be shaking in their boots. Now, like, here's the thing. Hans Zimmer was shaking in his boots. The Hans Zimmer, who is one of the greats, one of the top five currently working, he was shaking in his boots when he did Man of Steel. He's like, how can I top the Superman theme that John Williams did? How can I top that? You know, and he's aware of it. He knows that John Williams is one of the best, if not the best, but he did something that was really great. And so, anyway, I'm talking for a long time. All I'm saying is that John Williams is great, and he's inspired great music, he does great music, and I feel like the people who take over for him once Star Wars 8 or 9 happens, I think they'll be able to continue a great legacy that he's established.
Yeah, and if anything that makes me the most curious about Force Awakens in December is hearing what he's done for the new film, because him and Star Wars are just synonymous, and it would be a tall order to do something as iconic again as Duel of the Fates and even the original Star Wars themes that he did back in the 70s, but he might be able to do it. He's the one person who can outdo himself, and you even get a little taste of it, because if I'm not mistaken, with the Force Awakens teaser that came out, of course the Star Wars theme is his, but I even think that the music that played at the underlining the first part of that trailer is part of the new score. I think I heard that it was part of the new score. And if it was, then I think we're in good hands. Well, we always were in good hands with John Williams, but I think what I'm trying to say is he hasn't lost his Star Wars touch.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I'm really looking forward to it. And before we move on to the next one, I just have to say, just to give myself a little bit more nerd cred, I have an original 1977 vinyl pressing of the Star Wars score. And it's amazing.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure that goes for a ton of money now, too, if you ever sold it.
And I never will. All right, what's your next one?
My next one is from a composer that I don't think anyone really knows the name of, unless you're really in the nerd know, but you've heard his score before, and you've definitely heard this score before. The composer I'm talking about is Brad Fidel, and that might not be a name that comes immediately to mind, but it should when you talk about the main theme from Terminator, and specifically Terminator 2. Brad Fidel is the one who's composed the iconic Terminator score. He did it for T1. Of course, back then it was low budget, so it was very much on a synthesizer, Casio, that sort of deal. Mm-hmm. Still was a cool theme. I really liked the music from Terminator 1. But when he gets to do the full orchestral version for the main title for Terminator 2, I just remember I saw Terminator 2 for the first time it was at my first summer after college. I'd never seen them before. So that was 2008. So it's recent that I've seen the Terminator films for the first time. And I just remember hearing that score over my surround sound and just thinking how amazing and epic it was. And, you know, this is a film in 1991. When we think of these big budget films, I think we tend to think of these post-millennium huge budget special effects. But this was just so fantastic. And it took the score from T1 to a whole new other level. And no one can think of Terminator without hearing those drums. So we have Brad Fidel to thank for that.
I'm really glad that you brought this up. I'm really glad that you chose this and put this on your list, because you're right. I didn't know this person's name, and I didn't know it before now. And I'm looking at his filmography right now, and it's not filled with a lot of great, like for the people that we mentioned before, like John Williams and James Horner and Hans Zimmer, you know, like his filmography is not as impressive as this. Now, I'm not trying to belittle this man whatsoever, because he has some great stuff. I mean, the stuff that you mentioned just now from Terminator and Terminator 2 is enough to put him as the greats, because that is iconic. That has permeated our culture very distinctly. I mean,
to the point where, you know, Terminator Genesis trailers have those drums at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, you see him credited for Terminator 3, the Sarah Connor Chronicles, and Salvation just because they all use that theme, because why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you use that theme? That theme is Terminator. Terminator is that theme.
Right, and I'd be surprised if it doesn't show up in Genesis, the actual film.
Oh, it absolutely has to. It has. It's a rule. It's got to be a law somewhere in Hollywood, like a written down law that has to be used for any incarnation of the Terminator. All right, well, we'll move on to my number two, which is this one. I talked a lot about this movie in the past, and this is not just me fanboying because I love the franchise so much and because I thought it was ended too early, but this is because I genuinely believe that this music is beautiful. And I know people use that word a lot. Everything's beautiful. My latte in the morning is beautiful, you know, and everything like that. But I believe that this piece of music is truly beautiful, and that is Serenity in the movie Serenity by David Newman. This movie, it's also by Joss Whedon.
Yeah, Joss Whedon gets two entries this week.
He gets two entries this week, and Serenity has one of the best intros of any movie ever because it's layers upon layers upon layers. With every new scene, you delve deeper into what you thought was something else. And then all of a sudden you see, bam, it goes to black. It just cuts to black and the music stops. And then you just see Serenity, the title, come out of the black, which is a very, very important motif and theme in the picture and also in the series. It just comes out of the black, and then you hear the rise of the strings, and you see that Serenity is actually, it's not just a movie title, it's painted onto the ship, and it's the first time you see the ship, and it's just, it's rising and rising and rising, and then the ship hits the atmosphere, and then bam, the music hits as well. You don't just hear the strings, but you hear all the other instruments, and it's fun, it's Western, but it's also orchestral, and it just makes me smile just talking about the music, and I love it so much.
And I've only seen Serenity a couple times, but I'm going to credit not only the composer, David Newman, who is fantastic, you know, has always been fantastic, but it's something about the pairing with Joss Whedon. I think he just knows how to elicit the scores that he wants from his composers. And that's why I'm, you know, even thinking back to now Age of Ultron, I'm not even worried that it's not Alan Silvestri anymore, because whatever the score will be, it will pair just fine and it will elicit the right emotion. And that's all really, that's what a good score does. It elicits the right emotion at the right time.
Well, I'm not going to kiss Joss Whedon's butt too much.
I'm not trying to. I'm just saying that, you know, I'm just saying that a good composer compared with a good director is magic.
I completely agree with you. And if you listen to the commentary of Serenity, you have a cast commentary with Joss Whedon, and you also have just a straight up director's commentary. And he says a lot of flattering things about David Newman and David Newman's process. What happened is that before they made the film, like, David Newman came up with a few themes for Joss Whedon, and he wrote River's theme. And for those of you who don't know, River is a very tormented character in the franchise, and she's a little off. She's kind of insane because the government did some experiments on her brain. And so what David Newman did, he composed River's theme on a water-damaged piano.
Really?
So that he would get warped, like it had warped wood, and so it would get warped notes, and it would very, very interesting sound. And so he took that, like he composed it while he was by himself on this warped piano, and then played it on a normal piano and added some effects. When he presented that to Whedon with the story, Whedon said, he gets it. He understands it. I picked the right guy because he gets the character. He doesn't just write music because it sounds cool. He does it because it expresses the emotion of that character.
Right. That's really cool. I didn't know that about River's theme.
Yeah, and it's just in fact, you know, like instead of just playing the Serenity theme, I'll play a little bit of River's theme right here, and you'll know what I'm talking about once you hear those a couple of notes, you'll understand how it came from a warped piano.
That's so cool. I love it when things happen that way. And you know, I'll talk about one later that kind of follows that sort of funny accident sort of thing. But I guess we're moving on to my number two.
That's right. You're number two. Actually, wait, no, I have one more thing to say about David Newman. Just one more thing.
Please do. Please do.
I moved to Los Angeles for a little bit. I got some education here, and I also got a job, and I didn't like it. I didn't really like it. That's why I moved back to Chicago and finished my degree and got married. One of the first nights I was there, I went to the Hollywood Bowl, which they have a lot of concerts at.
Mm-hmm.
And it was I didn't know I didn't know everything about it. And so as I'm walking in, all it was the music from Paramount Pictures. That's all I knew it was going to be. It was going to be a collection of music from Paramount Pictures. And then as I walk in, I see signs everywhere, and it says that it's conducted by David Newman. And this was after Serenity came out, and so I was just like, oh, holy crap, it's David Newman. Man, he's going to be conducting some of my favorite stuff from Paramount Pictures. That's so great. And as I'm walking to my seat, Leonard Nimoy walks up to the podium and introduces himself and David Newman and says hello to everyone. And I had no idea who was going to be there, and he hosted the entire night. I literally cried as I walked to my seat because I was just beside myself. I was like, I'm the center of filmmaking in the world. I'm about to listen to some of the greatest scores ever conceived by man, conducted by David Newman, and hosted by Leonard Nimoy. It was a perfect moment.
And not only that, put on at one of the most famous concert spots in Hollywood, Los Angeles.
Yeah, in Los Angeles. It was a perfect moment. And so I just had to say that. And like, that's another reason why I have a special connection with David Newman.
That's awesome. That's a great story. I love that.
All right. What's your number two?
My number two is one that, we've already kind of briefly touched on it somewhere earlier in this podcast, and it was conducted by the John Barry Orchestra. It's one of the coolest themes of all time, and that would be the James Bond theme from Dr. No, and that has been used in every movie since. You can't have a James Bond movie without this theme, and I really don't think I need to explain why I like this theme. It's just the epitome of cool, and I specifically got, when I was getting because we're playing the themes under our explanations for the show, I specifically got the original recorded theme because that's my favorite version. I like the new one that they reorchestrated for Casino Royale, but nothing's going to beat that original 1962 recorded version.
Nothing's going to beat the original whatsoever, And also, I loved it. I absolutely loved it because we talked about the Spectre teaser trailer at the beginning of the show.
They used it.
Just that little bit of triangle, just in the beginning.
I thought it was like, it almost was a xylophone or something like that.
Welcome, James. It's been a long time. And finally, here we are.
I don't know. Like, maybe it was xylophone, maybe it was a triangle. I don't know. It's really faint. Really,
It's right at the end when Christoph Waltz is saying, "Mr. Bond, it's been such a long time."
Oh man, nothing gets me going like surprise Bond theme. I mean, like you hear just little bits of it. It almost reminded me of the GoldenEye video game. Did you ever play?
Yeah,
that?
Yeah, of course I played that. That's my introduction to Bond. I mean, I was at the right age for that.
I mean, like, I remember, like, just, like, you're playing the game, you're on your 64, you're going through a tunnel, and you hear this you hear this really rudimentary version, and it's just a really, it's like a triangle or a xylophone, it's just like, it's just, like, underneath, and you're shooting up 8-bit guys and everything like that. It's just so great.
I can't wait to see what they do with it in Spectre. They always do something very interesting with it in each of these films. But yes, the original version recorded in 1962 that, even though it immediately calls to the franchise as a whole, just in my mind makes me picture Sean Connery, which is awesome, you know.
And also, I mean, like, he has another Bond connection with A View to a Kill.
Well, yes. Yes.
He actually did the song for Duran Duran. Like, he did the music for Duran Duran.
Yes.
Which, I freaking love that song. I love that song.
One of these days, Tristan, I think we'll probably do this as Spectre Gross Chloris, or we're going to have to do our top five Bond themes.
You know what, I think you're right. I mean, like, I think for the rest of this year, we're going to be slowly transitioning into our Bond love. But one, like, before we move on to our top picks, John Barry is, I love John Barry, not only for Bond, but for The Lion in Winter. Did you ever see that movie?
I've seen bits and pieces. I didn't know he did Lion in Winter. This is the one with Katharine Hepburn?
Yes, that's right. It's based off of a play, and the movie version has Peter O'Toole and Katharine Hepburn, Anthony Hopkins, Timothy Dalton, John Castle, Nigel Terry. It's just an amazing movie, and if you haven't seen it, you need to see it. It's brilliantly written, but the music is special. It's over the top. It's epic. It's great, and I know we keep using the epic word a lot, and it could get overused, but we're using it in the right context. And if you haven't heard it before, check it out. All right. Well, I guess it's down to our number one.
Yeah. So without further ado, what is your number one pick, Tristan? You said you had this concrete, so.
This is my legitimate number one pick. This is not just interchangeable like my 5 through 2. I want to preface this a little bit. And you know I love prefacing before I get into the actual answer. And this one is very near and dear. I cannot listen to this score without getting emotional. And I mean that. This is not hyperbole. This is not me saying like, oh, it touches me. No, I get emotional just hearing the first couple of notes from any piece from this score. Part of the main reason why I haven't seen the movie in a long time, because the music gets to me so deeply. And it was one of the first movies that I saw with my wife, my now wife. And it's our movie. Like if you ask us what our movie was, you know, like how some people have a song or something like that. We have a movie, and this is that movie. A quote from this movie is inscribed inside my wife's engagement ring. And this music, it's on another level. And I don't think this composer gets enough credit. It's Clint Mansell. Mm-hmm. And it's from the movie The Fountain, and it's called The Last Man.
That's fantastic.
For those of you who just heard, like, as you can tell, it's very, it's slow, it's impactful, it, like, the strings tug at your heartstrings. And
somber, very somber.
Thank you. That's what I was looking for. It's very somber. It's just, if you know anything about the movie, and I can't even describe the movie, it is one of the most underrated films of all time. People hated this movie. They absolutely hated it. People thought it was a waste of film. It got a horrible rating on any site that you go on, like whether it's IMDb, Rotten Tomatoes, Metacritic. It is a horrible, horrible rating, and I don't understand it. I don't get it.
It's Darren Aronofsky. He can bring that out in people. I didn't know that until I actually listened to it and saw that, you know, directed by Darren Aronofsky. He's one of those people that gets he either gets critical acclaim or he gets critical hate. His movies are never in between.
You're very right. You either love it or you hate it. There is no in between. And the main person that Clint Mansell works with is Darren Aronofsky. And so whenever you hear a Darren Aronofsky, whenever you see a Darren Aronofsky film, you're going to hear a Clint Mansell score. And whether you hate or love that film, you're going to love the score.
I'm curious, did he do Black Swan?
He did Black Swan.
I love Black Swan, so there you go.
And I hated Black Swan.
See, well, there's just you hating good things again.
No, I could back up why I hate Black Swan But that is another podcast. But the thing is, with this music, it's one of those themes. It's one of those scores, like I said, where you don't even need the movie to feel that emotion. And now, granted, I saw the movie, and so I have that equated with the music. But I feel like if you listen to it on its own, it's one of those moments where, you know, back in the day where people would just, like, I know people still go to symphonies today, but it was much more popular before radio, before television, before film. This is one of those scores. You would go and pay money just to listen to this score.
Well, and to your point, I mean, I had, you know, had the benefit of just listening to the score. Now you provided me with a link. I never heard it this before because I'd never seen this movie before. And if I didn't know it came from a movie, I would have thought that this was a piece of classical music by some sort of classical composer. It's a symphonic score, which is really not something you get a lot of these days.
Yeah, no, it's really not. And I feel like Clint Mansell is most known for Requiem for a Dream.
Oh, did he do, what's it called, Lux Aeterna or whatever it's called?
That's him, yeah.
Okay, all right.
See, that's the thing is that, like, most people know him from that because that song, what you just quoted, was used in everything. They used it everywhere.
Well, it's trailer music. And most notably, remember when they used it for Lord of the Rings? That's when everybody found out about it.
Yeah, it was in Lord of the Rings, Two Towers. And it was a rearranged version. And also, every single film student in the history of the world used this in some capacity.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And they used it and they killed it. And they absolutely killed it. You can't hear that song anymore without thinking, oh my God, this is used in everything. But
another cliched student film.
Exactly. But the thing is, like, if you try to separate yourself from its history.
Oh, it's a brilliant piece of music.
Exactly. And so is The Fountain. And a lot of people don't know about it because the movie was panned by critics so hard. But do yourself a favor. Even if you hated the film, even if you hate Darren Aronofsky, listen to the music by itself and you'll know what I'm talking about.
Well, now that you mentioned that he was the one behind Lux Aeterna, I can hear it now.
Absolutely,
like,
yeah.
Like, I could tell that from the Fountain score that, yeah, that's the same guy.
He also did Moon.
Oh, the Sam Rockwell film?
Sam Rockwell, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's his most recent one. I'm not quite sure. No, his most recent one would be Noah, because that was Darren Aronofsky.
Darren Aronofsky, yeah.
But he also did music for Mass Effect 3, which is freaking insane. But I've been talking for a long time. What's your number one?
Well, I kind of feel bad going with my number one, you know, because you brought out something so classy and I'm going to bring out something so simplistic. But I think that's the beauty of this last one. And sometimes I think the tendency these days is for composers to go for big scores and big crescendos and just make it huge and make it epic. And sometimes that's to the detriment of the film. And sometimes what all films need is a very simplistic score. And I feel like a lot of those simplistic scores are born out of a sense of not even having enough money for an orchestra or any sort of professional recording background or whatever. Like, they just didn't have the resources. And so my number one, a film that I've mentioned I don't know how many times on this podcast, and I would really have to think about it, but it might actually be my concrete number one, is John Carpenter's Halloween theme.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, you go with your favorite tracks, you go with your gut, you go with what affects you, and that you love this music.
And I had to, because I saw this film when I was 14, and I heard everyone, or when I read about this film beforehand, all I heard was the Halloween theme. Best thing about the movie is the theme song and the score that goes with it. And I had never heard it before, and then I watched the film, and it was late at night, it was dark, I had my surround sound turned on. And it's so simple. All it is, and this is the thing I love about this movie, because I've heard Carpenter talk and in documentaries and on commentaries, is that when he originally screened the film for studios, and the reason it's not a studio film when he was seeking distribution, he was trying to go through a major. And I remember him saying, I showed the film to someone from 20th Century Fox who said, this isn't scary, but it was because he hadn't put the score over the film yet. Mm. So he showed him a non-scored version of the film. And I still think it's a film that probably could work without a score, but the score is so synonymous with the film that, like, I can't imagine it being without score. And that theme, all it is, all the way he composed it, is just a 5-4 rhythm that he played on bongos, because he had a set of bongos when he was younger, and he kind of just fooled around with it and then translated it to a piano and a synthesizer. And that's all it is it's a 5-4 theme just alternating downwards in pitch. That's it. That's all the Halloween theme is, and yet it's become, in horror circles, one of the most iconic themes of all time. It's in every film. Every time a new Halloween comes out, they have to use it somewhere. So I don't think there's... I can't even imagine not having that score or that theme on this list, and certainly not anywhere else than number one. I love it so much. I'm a Carpenter fan to this day. A couple months ago, he released an album of just new themes that he wrote. Not for any movie. He's just... he was fooled around in a synthesizer. Mm-hmm. And it's fantastic. I love this man's vibe. Just give him a Casio and whatever, and just let him work. I love him. I love him. Carpenter, love you always. So Halloween theme number one.
No, you shouldn't be sad by picking this, because I think this is a great choice. It's iconic. It is the very definition of iconic. And if I had to pick one of your favorites, this would definitely go in it, because this means something so close, because this means something so much to you.
And the one last thing I'll say about it is, the thing I love about him most is that he does his own scores. You don't get a lot of, director song composers. So there we go.
That's very true. Well, that was our episode on our top five favorite scores of all time. And as we said, it's our favorite scores, not what we think is the best of all time. It's just pieces of music that mean something to us. Well, tell us what your favorite scores are. Tell us what you think of our list. Tell us if you think we're full of crap, or tell us what you're like, oh man, how can you not mention this? Please email us at contact@thenerdparty.com, or even better, you can go to our Facebook page. Go to facebook.com/thenerdparty. There you can interact with us and talk with us, and please like our page. And you can also find us on Twitter. You can find me at @TheInsaneRobin.
And you can find me at mhanson0207.
And please, if you can, go to iTunes and rate us. If you give us a 5-star rating, we'll give you a mention on the podcast. More ratings means we'll get on higher lists, and we'll get noticed by more people. We'll get more fans, more interactions. And only good things can happen if you give us a 5-star rating. So please take the time, give us a rating, and if you could, give us a review as well.
Thank you so much for listening, everybody. And this is Matt Hansen for the Nerd Party saying, cue and music.
Coming up next week.
Meeting you with a view to wake in. Face to face in secret places. Feel the chill.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
For years and years, heating has meant boilers, and boilers have meant breakdowns. Over here and over here. Anything but music to your ears. At Fisher Future Heat, we create state-of-the-art home heating systems that we fit, then you forget. With no annual servicing needed and a huge 10-year guarantee. In short, we engineer common sense. Search Fisher Future Heat today. Fisher Future Heat. The future is electric.